The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Kurt Benrud with the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Sci-Fi. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi. This story is titled The Overlords and Their Wizards by Steve Lance. The war has raged for 100 years. The peace talks nearly as long. Evenly matched, the young warriors maimed and killed each other day after day, year after year. The soldiers are told from birth that they must fight. In doing so, they bring honor to themselves. But the battlefields are nothing but a human butcher shop, and they see in their opponents' eyes the same innocence and humility as their own, and they wonder why they must kill. Meanwhile, negotiators meet to talk peace in a compound hidden high in the mountains, where the air is cool, the water is pure, and the gardens grow lush. They debate the terms, generation after generation, never coming close to a truce. But over the years, they agree to expand the compound, giving each negotiator a fine house. And they agree it should have every attainable luxury, and that there should be maids, cooks, and butlers to care for their every whim. That all of this is necessary so they can dedicate themselves to the serious work of finding peace. The overlords, who rarely interfere, declare enough. They grow tired of seeing young men hacked to death and watching the mothers weep as they bury their sons. So they instruct their wizards to use their magic and prevent the soldiers from striking each other. They seal the compound and tell the negotiators they cannot leave until a peace agreement is reached. The wizards travel to the blood-stained battlefield and cast a spell, causing the red carnations to grow wherever blood was spilled. As a result, a thick carpet of red flowers bloomed across the field, testifying to the sacrifices of the last 20 generations. When the soldiers see the flowers, sorrow fills their hearts. They lowered their heads and wondered how they could have participated in such brutality. The swords grow heavy in their hands, their grips loosened, and the weapons fall to the ground. The overlords declare there will be 3 days of mourning where the wives and mothers from both tribes will grieve together for their lost soldiers. This will be followed by a 3-day festival where both tribes will join together for feasting and games of leisure. During this time, the negotiators will work out a peace treaty. If unable to do so, it will not be the soldiers who return to the battlefield, but the negotiators. If their words cannot solve the differences, they will solve it with their own blood. On the first day of mourning, the mothers go to their holy sites and pray for all lost souls. They gather with their families on the second day, remembering their loved ones. On the third day, mourners of both tribes come together and grieve for the senseless losses they have endured. They see the sorrow and the love for the fallen in each other's eyes. They vowed to set aside their hatred and forgive one another. The festival begins with a feast provided by the wizards. A mile-long table is filled with food and drink. Each tribe sits on their respected side, but close enough to reach over and shake the hand of their former enemy. The war has left them with meager resources, and this is a feast like none has seen before. They eat and drink together and tell tall tales. On the second day of the festival, they compete against each other in friendly games. They play hard, but congratulate the winners. And on the third day, those who wish to take the stage talk about the new friendships formed. They pledged to put all past grievances aside and go forward with goodwill towards all. The wizards provide music, and they dance well into the night. Meanwhile, the negotiators, unaware of the events taking place, are confined to the compound and instructed to work out a peace deal. The wizards take away the feather beds and throw straw on the floor. They fill the baths with blood from the soldiers who have died and replace the rich food with a daily ration of gruel. The negotiators find a lifetime of disagreeing, a habit hard to break. Each side demands the same concessions they have demanded for years. They demand territory from the other, but each already has plenty of land to meet their needs. They each demand gold for reparations, but both sides are at fault for continuing the war, and no one can remember who started it. Both insisted the other admit guilt. They have argued for so long they do not know how to agree. They were sure if they compromised, their tribe would remove them as negotiators. So, unwilling to sacrifice their lifestyle, they keep their tribes at war, even if it means the slaughtering of the young. After 6 days with no progress, they are told they themselves will do battle. The last one alive will set the peace terms. Both sides argued this is unfair. They are not soldiers. They do not know how to wield a sword, and all the rich food they have enjoyed has left their bodies unfit for combat. Their pleas go unanswered. They are given swords and told at daybreak the battle will begin. The negotiators remain unaware the tribes have made peace. With no lengthy discussion, only a handshake and the promise of friendship, the negotiators are irrelevant. The negotiators march into an arena conjured by the wizards. The two tribes fill the seats, not on different sides, but intermingled. Laughter fills the arena as they watch the negotiators try to swing the heavy swords. Several swing the sword, only to fall. A couple of them are out of breath from the walk to the arena. Finally, after a few minutes of watching, one of the former soldiers stands and shouts, "These men are no longer represent us. We have made peace on our own terms, and much as we are enjoying this display of incompetence, we do not wish to see these men die. The war is over, and these men's punishment for living in luxury while good men died is to be banished. They are to head into the wilderness with only what they can carry, and never bother us again. Now let us join our neighbors in one more night of merriment."
This is Monica Ho, and I'll be reading Deluge by J.S. Vedder. Min put her breather to her face, puffing from the climb. "Getting old," she chided herself. Were she still 70, she could have made it in half the time and not needed the breather. She'd timed it right. The clouds, which had been gathering on the horizon since this morning, towered high over the caldera and the dome, black at their base, a curled dark gray and lavender at their height. "This is it." It wasn't the first time Min had said that. Six? 6 times in the last half year they'd tracked clouds like this. 6 times Min had come out to watch. 6 times she'd returned to the dome, kicking dry reddish dust with her well-worn desert boots, telling herself, "Next time." Min lowered the breather, sucked in a thin lungful of Martian air. She could taste the water in the air. When was the last time she'd done that? Decades ago, before time and distance and muscle atrophy had banished her from Earth. There was a low rumble. Min felt a thrill in her gut. More lightning flickered staccato-like, and a fork of electricity tapped the desert floor. Another rumble, and the wind changed direction. Min's coat flew open, and she shouted with laughter. Not so long ago, standing outside like this, breather dangling from a slack finger, would have been unimaginable. Fine red sand leapt upward, whirled toward her. The light went flat as clouds scudded overhead. Then noise like tearing fabric. Min started, adrenaline surging, and the rain hit her. It was bitterly cold, that first man-made rain. More like sleet than rain, if Min were honest. It passed in seconds. Puddles dotted the regolith, speckled red. Min checked the horizon. She was alone. She chose the biggest puddle and jumped.
I'm Joanna LaForgia, and this is Earth's Lament by Avery Elizabeth Hurt. Yes, they are getting out of hand and will likely do themselves in sooner rather than later, and take not a few others with them when they go. Earth sighed and looked around. And you, dear? Jupiter asked. Will you be okay? Always solicitous, he refilled her glass without being asked. Oh, yes, I'm always fine. These infestations come and go. Anaerobic bacteria, invertebrates, dinosaurs. Actually, the change is refreshing. But these humans have been charming in their way, and certainly entertaining. They have become convinced that their desperate efforts to save themselves are actually attempts to save me. As if I can survive only in the conditions they need to survive. They've transferred their own terror of annihilation into a touching concern for me. It's really rather sweet.
Sounds more than a little self-involved, if you ask me, Jupiter said.
Earth picked up her glass and took a delicate sip. Well, yes. That is rather the problem, isn't it? I must admit, though, I'll hate to see them go. And, listeners, this is a brief note from the author, Avery Elizabeth Hurt, who says this story came to me when I was writing a book about the science of climate change. I kept noticing that people were saying we needed to save the Earth, but Earth isn't in any danger. What's in danger is the web of life humans depend on for survival. When we're gone, Earth will be just fine, if a great deal different. I wonder if Earth would miss us.
I'm Doris Hyde, and I'm reading Between Blood and Bone by Ian Waitz. In the space between blood and bone, the gap between gut and sinew, the nanobots set to work, sculpting and reshaping. There was no time to spare. He couldn't afford to go slowly or be gentle, so the process was brutal. A kaleidoscope of pain flooded his being. Piquancy layered upon dull ache, followed by deep throb, waves of hurt that chased each other across his awareness and back, as mass redistributed to conform to his will. The pain was an old friend, though. Finally, after eternal seconds of exquisite agony, it receded, ebbing away like a sigh lapsing into silence. His appearance was entirely transformed. Gone was the athletic, dark-haired young man in matte black, non-reflecting bodysuit. In his place, a far shorter, plumper woman, a slightly hunched-shouldered senior citizen in faded skirt and ill-fitting top. Instinctively, he reached to finger the stolen data chip, just to reassure him, herself, that it had survived the transition unaltered. They were on him even as she let go of the precious prize. His/her shock, as two uniformed security guards and a sleek, blue-liveried sniffer drone came barreling around the corner, didn't need to be feigned. They almost knocked him/her over. "Have you seen this man?" the lead guard demanded, with no preamble or thought of apology. The drone displayed an impressively clear image of the person she/he had been mere seconds before. For a fleeting moment, she was tempted to misdirect them, but that risked unwanted attention should they recognize the deception and retrace their steps. So she simply said, "No." Her voice emerged as cracked, dry, and higher pitched than intended. "He must have gone straight on," the second guard said. "Come on, or we'll lose him." The two guards turned to go, but the drone remained, hovering in the air an arm's length from her face. She eyed it warily. The drones were a pain and were fast becoming her biggest threat. Designed to isolate and follow individual pheromone traces even through a crowded urban environment, early models had been notoriously fallible, but they were getting better, much better. "Oh, for pity's sake," Guard One said, turning to Guard Two, "do something about your pet, will you? It'll be telling us a dog is our perp next." "I'm trying," the other said, fingers tapping at a wrist display. Finally, almost reluctantly, the drone jerked and then turned to follow its handlers. "Sorry about that, ma'am," Guard One said, an apology at last. "Technology, where would we be without it?" His voice was rich with sarcasm. "Where indeed," she replied softly, with no sarcasm at all. I'm Doris Hyde, reading Crave by A.M. Call. After determining that I had starved myself to invisibility, I left the bathroom, knocking down two margarita-soaked women. They shrieked in columns of tiny boozy bubbles. Horrified beyond speech, they watched my empty pants step over them. I felt weak and exhilarated. The others were gathered around our table. Dora, pale as salt, spat oyster crackers into a napkin. All I could see of Rob was his right arm with its IV nutrient drip. I spread my empty sleeves wide. Rob's arm trembled. "Jim!" Dora rose. Her enormous belly bumped my hollow one. "Do it," she whispered. Her eyes were closed. I ran my unseeable hand over her face, through her hair, imagining that I was the wind itself. Delicate white strands snapped between my fingers and floated gently to the ground. I shed my clothing and upended a heavy table of carrots and beets. Earthy vegans scattered like leaves. A kale-eater cowered. I threw a bowl of cherries at him as a woman flailed blindly with the tofu-soft fists. That's when the police showed up. They had infrared goggles and dogs. My lawyer says we may be able to use that in court. Whatever. When I was a kid, Mom would drown me in orange juice. The blinding, concentrated nausea would light me up with a need for her. My skin bubbled with something that hurt in a way that I loved. "What a sweet boy," her friends said. "Very bright." Then I would go to my mother and give her a sticky kiss. I'm Doris Hyde, and this is The Confectioner by Austin DeMarco. The secret is in how you cook the sugar. Too hot and the crystals will crack when removed from the pan. Too cool and all the delicate whorls and swirls will collapse like soft clay in a toddler's hands. People think there's magic involved, but it's far more complicated than that. It takes concentration, attention to detail, love. You really have to care about what you do. I learned to make the morning blossom from Ellen. 7 layers of sugar in the shape of a flower, pleasant enough to pay the ferryman's fee. She taught me the secrets, the tricks of our trade. She taught me to have a keen eye and a steady hand at all times. A single lapsed moment can spell ruin. The right tools are imperative. I use the spoon Ellen gave me, dipping it into the bowl of melted sugar and swirling it around the sides to make sure the confection has reached its proper consistency. I hold just a tiny amount on the spoon's pointed end, wave it over the hot pan, and leave behind strands of glistening sugar that sizzle as they cook. Ellen didn't just teach me, she raised me. Our father left for the war before I was born. He never returned. Before I had learned the meaning of grief, our mother followed him, claimed by a mixture of heartache and despair. Ellen crafted her mourning blossom through a sheen of tears, careful to wipe them away unshed. Salt water spoils the sugar. I watched, my young hands not yet steady enough for this work. Quickly now, layer after layer after layer, until all seven have been stacked precisely upon each other. The blossom takes its shape slowly, in pieces too subtle to track, until all have been laid. I place the spoon back in its bowl, a slight tremble touching the tips of my fingers before I clench my fist and regain control. I wait. I've been waiting a long time, ever since Mother died, for my chance to make a flower. The years I've spent practicing, training my hands, my eyes, my nose to detect the subtle change in scent that tells of the instant the sugar starts to burn. That is the moment, the knife's edge of transition, when the morning blossom is ready. Without hesitation, quick as a frog's tongue to the fly, I scrape my spatula along the bottom of the pan and lift the blossom from it. I hold my breath. Once a blossom has been made, it cannot be remade. Whatever the result, it is the person's only hope in the afterlife. On every blossom rests the burden of eternity for someone's loved one, someone's wife, husband, child. I bite my tongue, a sharp pain that draws me back to the present. The confectioner cannot dwell on such thoughts for long. The pressure is enough to kill. Involuntarily, I close my eyes. I almost do not want to look at what I have wrought, but I must. I must look at my blossom, must see the fate that I have set. I open one lid at a time and nearly weep at the crystallized sugar petals sparkling in the light from my kitchen window. My sister would be proud.
This is Dan Oliver reading The Wholesaler by Robert Dawson. Spring had come to the village. The snow slowly melted. The streams began to plash and chuckle, and once more the old wholesaler tripped along the road, carrying her basket lighter than dreams. Before she reached the first house, a child saw her and called out. Somebody else passed the word, and all over the village doors opened and people came out to buy her wares. She sold post holes to the farmers, donut holes to the baker, and 10,000 gimlet holes in assorted sizes to the carpenter. With every hole she sold, her pocket grew heavier with coins, and her basket grew heavier, closer to the natural weight of a basket. Girls on the verge of womanhood came up to her in shy twos and laughing threes to have their ears pierced. Old Billy Beckett, the well digger, threw down his pick and shovel, stretched his calloused hands, and clumped over. He interrupted her just as she was trading 2 dozen buttonholes for 3 mouse holes that Granny Brooke had found around her cottage and didn't need. "Sell me a hole 1 yard across and 10 deep," he said. She shrugged. "I'm sorry, but I've got nothing that large right now." "Useless bitch! There's only one sort of hole you have to sell, and that's..." A hole, a yard wide and 5 deep, appeared beneath his feet. He fell with a shriek and landed heavily in the earth at the bottom. She looked over the edge. "I'll be back next year with the other half." Then she hoisted her basket and walked away.
This story is called There Are No Butterflies on Proxima B by Kyle Robert Anisence. Dear John, how are you? I am well. I'm writing you this letter from the ship. Yesterday, me and Mama and Papa woke up in the space beds. We had already arrived at the colonies. It felt like a very long time, but we are still so sleepy. I had a dream about the caterpillars in our classroom, and you were there. They finally left their cocoons and became beautiful butterflies. I wanted to tell Mama about my dream, but she was crying, so I think she must have had a nightmare. She said she misses Aunt Katie and Grandma, but Papa wants us to be happy, so we should try to be happy. Papa knows what is best for us. He says, We are lucky we can leave the past behind and start fresh as a family. I asked Papa how long until we go home to Earth and I can see you. He patted my head and told me to go to the games room and make some new friends. Mama hugged me. I told her not to cry. We will be home soon, where everyone will be happy to see us. I wish I knew how long we are staying here. Did you know there are no butterflies at all in the whole Proxima system? I think it is a very strange place. I hope Papa will take us back home soon. I miss you already, John. Please write when you can. P.S. I hope I will be back before the caterpillars finally turn into butterflies and fly away. Will you tell them to wait for me? Love, Tina.
Transmission, Re-E. About to Go Down by Cosmo Mercurio. When I cut this cord, it will seem terrifying at first, but it is for your own good. The mechanics of it don't matter. I barely understand it myself. Some kind of malevolent signal. There are others like me who seem to be immune, but most of us go insane or kill ourselves. Not me. I have the curiosity of a cat. I spent years trying to identify it, and when I did, I refused to die until I traced it to its source. And then, instead of dying, I spent 20 years more working my way up in the facility, all the while pretending, all the while eating cat shit with a smile. When I cut this cord, we will not have much time. You must come to terms with reality, and quickly. They will come for me. They will put things back the way they want. Our only chance is if you all come together and refuse to eat one more ounce of cat shit. Things do not have to be like this. Things were not meant to be like this. Life could be beautiful if you will just wake up. When I cut this cord, you will be amongst the millions of Americans who look down at their dinner plates and see that their filet mignon is just fried cat turds. Many of the people you love will disappear. They did not exist. You've been ferrying potato sacks to school and making love to pillows. I'm sorry. You're welcome.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.